We're on the river today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Reggie McLeod is bringing Big River Magazine to us today, and we'll find out what's going on in that publication today on Scribble. Reggie, you're in town for a number of things this weekend.
For a big award that he got.
Yeah.
Last night at the River Action Awards Banquet, I got an award, a special recognition for publishing Big River for 25 years.
25 years already?
Yes. It seems like it's gone by pretty quickly. Looking back, yeah.
Yeah, it does go fast, doesn't it?
It does.
You get busy every day, and all of a sudden the days mount up to years, and here we are. But I think that this is extraordinary that you've made this magazine work. I think if you had presented this as an idea, that people would be somewhat skeptical.
And rightly so. It wasn't a particularly good business plan, and it's taken me about 22 or 23 years to sort it out. But I think we're kind of on a good track now.
Well, I remember when it came out, it was just a couple of folded sheets together, right?
Yeah, it was just 6 pages, black and white, the first year or two, and then we had 2 colors, and it grew slowly, yes.
Yeah, but it must have grown because it turned out to be popular, right?
Well, it was. It's as far as we know, it's the only independent magazine about a river in the world. And that's because it's kind of a tough business plan. But I think we focused on a certain region, which is a region from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities. And in the middle there is the Driftless area. So you have kind of a common culture and geology and so on. So we didn't try to tackle the whole river. We're just looking at 400 miles of the river, which is still a pretty good chunk.
What is so special about that section of the river?
Well, it's the best part of the river. First of all,
do I have to take a little prejudice here?
in my humble opinion, and it goes through the Driftless area, and that's the area that has all of the steep bluffs and springs and ridgetops and overlooks. And that's because during the last glacial era, the glaciers went on both sides of it, even to the south of it, but the glaciers didn't go across the Driftless area. So all the rest of the country around the Driftless area got kind of flattened out by the glaciers, and the Driftless area still maintained those steep bluffs and valleys and caves and springs and all the things that that I really value.
It does make it certainly more scenic than any other stretch of the river, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, if you get south of St. Louis, and there's the river, you know, and the levees on each side are so high you can hardly look over them. So essentially you're driving down a canal. But, boy, you drive from Winona, for instance, up to Red Wing, you're going through some beautiful territory.
Yeah, that's the part of the river you want to traverse. It really is. I wonder, you know, as I subscribe to the magazine and I read it, and I think the articles are interesting, but the ads are the things that really grab you.
That is incredible. In fact, Big River is the only magazine that I subscribe to that I read from cover to cover, but I read it from the back cover to the front cover. You know, so your remarks are the last remarks rather than the opening remarks.
Save the best for last.
And part of that is because those ads are just so delicious. You see the ad. Look at this little bookshop here. Oh, yeah. Look at this coffee house. We got to go there, right?
Yeah, that's the thing.
And do you have a person who does these ads, or does each little bookstore or B&B design their own ads?
Well, we have 2 ad people, and one of them, Yarrow Brown, designs many of the ads. A lot of the advertisers submit ads that we just run, but we offer free help with the advertising. So a lot of people use that, and Yarrow is very talented. But also we're really focusing on people use the word unique a lot. They misuse it a lot. Unique really means that there's only one of something. You can't be very unique. You're either unique or you're not unique. And the vast majority of these businesses are one-offs. There's not another one. So they're not a franchise or a chain or a big international corporation. They're locally owned, often family businesses. And in part, that's because our circulation isn't big enough for us to justify charging a lot of money. So that makes it affordable for advertisers, smaller businesses. But also our audience is very targeted. This isn't a general interest magazine. This is a magazine for people who are interested in the river and also river communities and history and so on. So people in these river communities really have a good conduit to the sorts of people that are likely to be their customers. So it's efficient for the small businesses and for the casinos and, you know, the big chain stores. It's below their radar. So they're not particularly interested.
Well, you know, thinking about it, that's always been true of life along the river. The steamboats were essentially mom-and-pop organizations.
Yeah, a lot of them, yeah.
Compared, and then it comes the railroad, which is corporation with stocks and stuff, and the steamboats have no chance. But even though there were steamboat lines, those lines never consisted of more than maybe three or four steamboats that would get together and agree on something. But essentially, it was mom and pop. The steamboat, the Caulky Boatyards was, you know, a family-run boatyard, nothing big, right? Uh-huh.
Well, the trick in magazine publishing, though, is to have ads, because no getting around it. Ads support publications. And in this computer age where people go on the internet and social media and so on, keeping a magazine alive is not an easy trick.
No.
But you seem to have solved it.
Yes. I think of it a little bit now as kind of a boutique business. You know, people enjoy the quality of having nice color on paper. That's always going to look better than a screen. And the convenience of just being able to pick up something or stop in the middle. I mean, magazines are very usable, and we're trying to take advantage of that with the design of Big River Magazine and with the focus of it. And it appears to be working. I mean, we're not going to be competing with National Geographic or anything, but we can make a living of it and serve the community. I think people recognize, too, that we have an interest in seeing the river to be healthier and river communities to be healthier, but we don't have a party line. We're looking at all these problems from various perspectives, and I think that's healthy and useful. I think our readers recognize that. We do offer the magazine as a digital version, but we only have maybe three people that subscribe to it that way. They'd rather have the paper. They'd save a little money if they get the digital version, but I think people value the paper.
Yeah. How far from the Mississippi River do your subscriptions go?
Well, they go all over. We don't have many international ones anymore because the postage has gotten prohibitive. But we have people in California and Boston and so on.
Who have lived on the river or?
Probably. They're probably people who are expatriates, you know, from river communities. And then we have a lot of snowbirds. We have a lot of addresses that switch to Arizona and Florida in the winter, and then they switch back up here in the summer. But really the bulk of the subscribers are within 40 or 50 miles of the river. We're getting more of them, you know, in Iowa City and Rochester, Minnesota, Madison, Wisconsin, that kind of thing. So we are spreading out more around the fringes of the Driftless area, too, as well as being centered on the river.
Well, people are mobile. You know, people move around and they like to go. So it's nice to find an interesting place to go that's not that far away.
Oh, yeah. I think people think of nature and exotic opportunity is being on the other side of the world or in the Arctic or the rainforest. And we're really trying to show people that there's a lot of fascinating things right literally in their backyards and trying to help them to value those things.
Well, a lot of people come from those exotic places to see the Mississippi River.
Well, that's true.
You know, we've had guests come from like South America and, I want to see the Mississippi River, right?
Yeah.
And you know, most of us grow up thinking, ho-hum, you know,
yeah,
it's the river. And without realizing, you know, when I first moved to the Quad Cities in 1960, virtually the whole river, river communities have turned their backs on the river. The levee in Rock Island and Davenport were sloping parking lots with parking meters. So that if there was a flood, you could see a little row of parking meters disappearing down into the water. And then suddenly in 1983, for some reason, people, outsiders, discovered eagles. And they came to the Quad Cities and, I want to see eagles. And I can remember saying, what eagles? Literally, right? I mean, Junior League, which the River Action was an outcome of, declared that the year of the river. And literally, since 1983, we have rediscovered the river. We really had to rediscover it. And the result is Schwebert Park and places like that.
Yeah, it's there's really been a renaissance, an awakening and awareness of where we are and the treasure we have. And as water becomes oil in the next century, the quest for water will be like the quest for oil today, because water resources are evaporating. They really are. And the great glaciers that feed rivers are retreating. The Mississippi is a treasure. And if you don't take care of it, Lord knows what will happen.
Well, I mean, part of your shtick, Reggie, seems to be to remind us that we need to take care of the river. And this award you got was not only for having Big River for 25 years, but it was for highlighting some of the problems the river faces, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
And what are those?
Well, we have a whole bunch of new ones with climate change, actually.
Right.
The whole hydrology of the river is changing dramatically, and the way that people are dealing with floods and dredging it and so on is changing. The biggest challenge to water quality right now is agriculture, and chemical plants and cities and everyone else has had to clean up their act and keep nutrients out of the water. And farming has been kind of a protected class for a long time. And frankly, it's harder to resolve those problems in agriculture because with manufacturing or processing or municipal sewage, you have a single pipe. So you can get everything, you can treat it, clean it, and then you put the clean water in the river. But with agriculture, you're spreading stuff out on sloping land, and then it rains, it washes into the creek and so on. So it's a more complex problem, and hopefully we'll resolve it because it's literally poisoning the water. You could see what happened to Lake Erie a few years ago in western Lake Erie. Large cities had to shut down their water intakes from Lake Erie because there were neurotoxins, deadly neurotoxins, in the water because of algae in the water that were growing there because of the phosphorus and nutrients that had run off from farmland. So that problem is reaching a crisis point in a lot of parts of the world. The dead zone is a symbol of that. So that's the biggest problem right now for water quality is agriculture.
And the difficulty is that every farmer worth his salt is a rugged individual and is going to take care of, you know, his or her property and crop and do whatever it takes to bring that crop in. And
well,
we have to find another way.
Yeah, we do. And, there's a lot of good farmers. Farmers don't all believe and do things the same. But really, the good farmers are punished because if they take a little more effort and expense to do a better job of farming, when they go to sell their corn or soybeans, they get the same price as the guy who cuts corners and is causing a lot of damage and saving money. they get the same price when they sell their crop. So I really think you need a little tighter standards that are fair and enforced equally, you know, with all farmers. And that'll make it easier for the farmers because they'll be more competitive. The good farmers will be more competitive with the poor farmers. And just set some minimum standards that are enforced consistently. We've tried all kind of volunteer things for decades. I worked for the Soil Conservation Service back in the mid-70s for briefly. And there's a lot of places I drive to now that we worked on that are in poorer shape than they were in the mid-70s. They've taken the contour strips out. They used to have hay contour strips or alfalfa contour strips that slowed down the erosion and protected the fields. People don't have dairy farms anymore, so they don't need the hay, and they take those strips out. And they want to grow more corn to export, and that brings the price down. So they can't make money.
Right.
I mean, they're kind of caught in a vicious circle that is not doing them any good. So I think there'd be some benefits to farmers to having some consistent standards that were applied. There would certainly be a benefit to our water, not just rivers, but even the well, you know, the groundwater.
And when you look at the Oglala water table dropping, continuing to drop so dramatically. It was dropping rapidly when I was on the Water Commission back in the 70s, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
And it continues to drop.
Yeah.
And you think there is an end to this, you know. I mean, you can only keep going down so far, and pretty soon you're going to run out of water.
Yeah.
And then what are you going to do? We're not recharging it. And it takes time. It takes a long time to recharge those underground aquifers.
Oh, yeah. If you stop putting the nitrogen on the land, a lot of these wells have nitrate levels that are poisonous to infants. If you stop putting nitrates on the land right now, it might take decades before all that nitrogen that's in there works its way down to the water table. So even if we stop now, it would be decades before we'd see benefits in a lot of places. So it's kind of a burden on future generations that isn't really fair, I think.
It isn't fair, but, you know, we're in kind of a me generation. We think short term. What's going to work short term?
Yeah.
And I don't know how you reestablish that sense that we're part of a long continuum and what's coming in the future we won't experience, but they have the same rights as we have. And if we don't share things with the future generations, it's as if we're all running up to Armageddon. It'll be all over in the...
Right.
And people will vanish and the earth can heal itself and you start all over again.
Yeah, well, that might be what it takes. I see the big change that I've seen in my life was when I was a kid, we were citizens. The people, neighbors, we were regarded as citizens. And now human beings in this country are regarded as consumers. And before, our duty with citizenship was to take care of other people in the infrastructure in the nation, and now it's to consume, so you'll drive economic activity and create jobs. That's the model that we live with now, that people kind of identify with that. And you never hear the word citizen anymore. Even politicians don't use that word, you know.
Yeah, we look at economic models as if they were holy writ.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the inflexible laws of capitalism. Well, we found out they're pretty flexible after all.
Right.
Yeah. Supply and demand sometimes becomes a joke. The self-correcting market, we know that doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to think afresh. And starting with the needs of the earth is a good place to begin. And you're certainly doing that with your magazine.
Well, thank you. We're trying.
And you're doing it. I heard three people talking about Big River the other day, and particularly the way in which you address these problems, fracking, you know, I guess that's not as much of a problem as it once was since or is it the sand mines?
Well, it is. The price of oil is going up. They're going to be
discussing the way in which you handle this, not in a vitriolic way, but in a much more gentle way. And they really appreciated, instead of getting on a soapbox and preaching, right? You gently remind, and I think.
Well, you know, but the price of oil, as we record this, is ridiculous because there's no rational justification for the price of oil going up. There's plenty of oil. It's all over the place. We have a glut of oil, and yet the prices are going up. How is that rigging the law of supply and demand? I mean, but we're doing it for economic reasons. And how do we get back to doing it for all living things? It's not just us and our short term on this earth. There are other creatures, and the more you look at life, the more you find the interrelationship between all things. And we cannot survive unless all other forms of life survive. We cannot survive unless the land survives. These are crucial, critically important problems.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we pay much attention to them.
No, I was looking this morning at maps of the United States where we will be when the sea level rises. And
right.
There are states,
yeah.
Florida virtually disappears.
Right.
And much of Mississippi disappears, and about half of New Jersey. I mean, it's like putting a frog in hot water and turning up the heat, and they don't notice it until they're cooked. I mean, we're that frog right now, and it's happening so slowly. People just don't really get it.
The thing is, people don't want to hear that.
Yeah,
they would prefer to be left alone and to enjoy their lives the way they'd like it right now, without any restriction, without any reservations for other things. And I don't know how we build a sense of community. We have evolved. You go back in history and you see how people identified themselves as part of a tribe, or their identity was locked up with other people's identity. But now we continue to evolve as sharply individualized creatures. We think of ourselves. How do we build a community of all these rugged individualists? How do we come together? And if you can solve that, you can get the Nobel Prize.
One of the reasons, as Roald said, that I'm not beating people over the head with these things is I don't have the answers. I mean, I can see the problems, and I can see a lot of good potential ways to solve the problems, and that's what we're trying to present. Sometimes I think game theory. I'd like to learn more about game theory, and that's kind of how people work together, how you make it so that something is to the mutual benefit of a group or several people, you know, to get out of that individual. To show that demonstrates how just kind of greedy individualistic decisions are often harmful to that individual. I mean, game theory kind of works into those sorts of scenarios. And I think we have some work to do there, but I don't know if human beings are really well equipped to be proactive about things. That's what worries me sometimes. I don't know if intellectually we have the hardware.
There's some wonderful books out. We Never Think Alone is a good one, pointing out the fact that we don't really think the way we think we think, that we generally take what a kind of consensus is, and we lean on that. And a good physiologist, psychologist will tell you that to use the mind at all takes a good 20% of all the body's energy. You don't realize how much pure energy your brain is occupying. But if you think critically, it goes up to 25%.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And in other words, if instead of just accepting, that sounds right, if you stop and think, now, wait a minute, maybe this, all of a sudden your brain goes into overdrive, and that takes more energy.
Yeah.
And psychologically, we resist that.
Well, I think people resist just thinking. I don't think we value that as an activity. And I was coming – before I came over here, I was in an elevator, and people are sitting there looking at their smartphones. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking, I take opportunities like that a lot of times just to think.
Yeah.
And people might think that I'm comatose or that I'm stupid or something. If I'm just sitting in a chair and I'm not looking at a magazine, although it's good to look at magazines, I'm not. But if I'm just sitting there staring into space, they think there's something wrong with me. But a lot of times, right, I take those opportunities just to think. There are things in our lives that we need to think about. And as simple as that seems, I really don't think we make time for that.
You know, I write a column once a week. And it's been suggested to me sometimes, why don't you work on your column ahead of time? I say, I'm running these things through my brain and trying to make sense out of them and trying to decide of so many topics in the world, what are you going to light on this time? And when I sit down to write, whatever comes to the surface is what I write about, even if it's something kind of stupid. But you spend a lot of time thinking. And that's a good way to spend your time.
Yes.
I want to ask you, though, where do you get the articles? Do you solicit articles? Do people submit articles to the Big River magazine?
People contact us and suggest articles, and we start a dialogue. Because we've been going for 25 years, and we really try to avoid repeating articles. And literally, the longer I do this, the more story ideas that I have rather than the fewer. We're really not using them up. So usually after that initial contact, I might say, well, we've done that story before, but maybe you could do a story like that about this place or this, you know, creek or something like that. And we'll kind of work together to find something we haven't done before and what angle to take on it and that. But it's rare for someone to contact us and say, oh, let's do a story on swans or let's do a story on the Rock River or something like that, and have it be something we haven't done before, mm-hmm. you know, and I have to explain that, and then we kind of work from there.
Do you get unsolicited manuscripts?
Rarely, and when we do, it's often kind of a commercial thing where somebody's paid someone to write a glowing feature story about their product or their campaign or something like that. We don't get very many good unsolicited stories. It's pretty rare.
Mm-hmm. So you pretty much have to generate or negotiate those things. Huh?
Yep. And we're always looking. We get some good story ideas from people, but usually, you know, the more successful ones will give us like 3 or 4 or 5 story ideas. And that helps because a lot of times there'll be a real gem in there and we'll take that and figure it out from there.
Well, I must say you have made something of Big River Magazine. And
have created a community, really, of this stretch of the river in a way that wouldn't have been. I mean, people are aware of what's going on up and down the river, I think, partly because of this magazine.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and of course it's available, isn't it?
It is. It's at Barnes & Noble, and we're at BigRiverMagazine.com on the web. There's all kinds of information, and actually stories that you can read. Some of our best stories are posted on our website.
Well, Reggie, thanks a lot for being here. We're clean out of time. We're listening to Reggie McLeod with Big River Magazine. Roll Tweet, and I'll be back next week with another session of Scribble. We hope you'll join us.